Hi, sweetheart. What are we talking about today?
We're talking about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, you told me a very interesting story this morning that had to do with coding, and I think that our audience would be very excited to hear about it.
I definitely wanted to get that on tape because it's a perspective that I think that most researchers aren't aware of. Most people kind of take for granted that they do a survey, that they know exactly how they're supposed to do the survey, and they're getting all the information they can out of the survey. And there's really five or six principles that I want to go over in the long run, which dramatically increase the quality and quantity of information you can pull out of a survey. But I think of all of them, this is probably the most important, even though it's also perhaps the most simple.
Well, that's really interesting. You mean people don't code their surveys when they do surveys?
Most people don't code their surveys outside of the marketing research industry. When I look at regular small business clients or peers or entrepreneurs who are doing surveys, they're asking these very short set of questions, which is okay.
Are they like with closed-ended questions and multiple choice or what?
I suppose the lower end of the spectrum would be people that are asking all closed-ended questions. And for those of you that might not recognize the word, closed-ended question is something where you determine the answers beforehand, like
yes or no.
Yes or no, or what did you have for dinner last night? Spaghetti, pizza, or chocolate bars?
Well, you know what? I wish I had.
I know. And an open-ended question would just be, what did you have for dinner last night?
And allowing for any response.
Mm-hmm. The critical difference is, if I say, what did you have for dinner last night? Spaghetti, chocolate bars, or pizza? Obviously, I'm imposing a predefined set of conditions that may or may not exist in the real world, and there are lots of things you might have had for dinner last night that aren't on my list, and there are lots of ways that you might want to tell me about it. There are lots of words you might want to use in describing what you had for dinner, which if I was running a restaurant or trying to create a menu that would entice you, I really need that language. So obviously, open-ended questions are much more important, but there's something way beyond this. There's something much more that you can do with the open-ended question. And to get at that, I kind of want to go back to motherhood. When I was in graduate school, I was very interested in attachment and the different types of attachment you could observe between mothers and their children.
And by attachment, you mean degrees of relationship?
Yeah. If you look at children, anybody who's had any exposure to kids can kind of see that there's these different types of attachment that kids get to their mother. Some of them are very securely attached, and they seem to be confident, you know, and they can walk away and come back, and they know that mom's going to be there, and there's like a calmness about it. And other kids are what they call anxiously attached. When they walk away, they get very anxious, and they run and they cling. And, you know, and then there are kids that are just not attached at all and don't really want all that much to do with their mothers.
And then there are kids who just cry and don't leave at all.
Yeah, that's true.
That was me when I was a kid.
Yeah. When I went to school as a clinical psychologist, I was very involved with the, I guess you'd call it the right brain of clinical psychology, as opposed to the left brain, meaning that I really thought that the gist of clinical psychology was sitting in a room with people and having an experience with them where you kind of merged with their feelings and thoughts.
Like intuitive.
An intuitive, artistic healing experience. And I was really shocked when I got to graduate school to see how the researchers were like breaking it down in a laboratory. And I have to tell you, my first response to that was, this is a human relationship. You can never break that down in a laboratory. I thought they were dead wrong what they were trying to do. But here's where I learned something different. They had graduate students observing mothers and their children, and they just had them sitting there with a stopwatch and a grid on a piece of paper and coding for different behaviors at different times. So if the mother was looking at the baby in the eye at 3 minutes and 2 seconds after the hour, you would check a little box that said the mother's looking in the eye. And if the mother was...
And record the time.
They record the time.
Like the length of the gaze.
The length of the gaze and the behaviors. And so every minute they would check, was the mother looking at them? What was the baby doing?
Were they touching the baby?
Was the baby crying? Was the baby trying to stand up? Was it sitting?
You know, smiling.
Smiling.
Whatever.
You know, juggling.
Juggling.
I'm just kidding.
That was you. Glenn juggles.
And it seemed like kind of an exercise in mental masturbation to me when I first saw it, and I was really against it.
You have to understand that Glenn was brought up by two right-brain clinical psychologists who were all about emotion and...
Yeah, I was brought up by two humanistic psychologists.
Right.
You'd be surprised, but if you looked at Dharma and Greg, I was like brought up by Dharma's parents.
Right.
Minus the drugs, kind of.
Right.
But so I was really against all of this coding, and I felt like it took the soul out of the
research. It didn't make sense
to you,
right.
But then when I looked at the numbers, and you could see that there was a strong relationship between when the mother was looking at the baby and how long she looked at the baby and when the baby cried. And more than that, they had follow-up data to show how the children did in school and how they did in social interactions and how they did on intelligence tests. I think that the studies have now actually been followed up into work, and it was incredibly significant, those pieces and parts. If you look back at what happened, you probably could have just had someone behind the mirror saying, is this mother attached to her baby or not?
Is she warm? Is she caring?
Yeah. Like you could.
How loving is she?
You probably could have crumpled up the piece of grid paper and just listened to what the researcher thought. And you would have gotten at the essence of the relationship. You could have gotten at the diagnosis of it. Is this an empathic mother? Is this a strong attachment or a weak attachment or an anxious attachment or a secure attachment? But what you didn't get at was, how do you make it better? And what particular elements of the attachment created that perception of strength or weakness or anxiety or confidence? And then it was very particular elements of the attachment that would correlate to school performance or social anxiety or a lot of the problems that are really facing us as adults in life. And we learned a tremendous amount from that set of studies by Beatrice Beebe and Margaret Mahler. So I'm going back to all this. Did you want to say something?
It just reminded me of that psychologist out on the West Coast, I think in Portland or Seattle.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Gutman.
Yeah, who brought couples in, and he used graduate students. He tracked people over time. He would set up an environment where he could test their GSR, their galvanic skin response, you know, with electrodes, and he'd have them have conversations, and he'd have different graduate students monitoring different aspects of behaviors and physical responses, and then he predicted whether or not they were going to stay together as a couple.
Right, it was something like a 98% accuracy.
It was
really
scary.
Amazing. Yeah.
I remember thinking, oh, do we want to go see him or not?
So, but here's the point. If you can predict how people are going to do in life, whether they're going to stay together as a couple, don't you think that with the same type of coding, if you code natural behavior like conversation,
mm-hmm.
don't you think with that same type of coding, you should be able to predict whether or not people are going to buy?
Yes.
And why they're going to buy?
You can establish the kinds of communications that will improve.
Absolutely. You can zero in on the aspect of the conversation in your prospect's head that is most particularly motivating and most directly matched to the purchase of your product. That's why I'm suggest about all this.
Right. And just like, you know, Dr. Gutman wasn't just doing it to show how smart he was in predicting whether or not a couple was going to stay together, but it gave them tools for counseling, saying, look, these are the kinds of behaviors where couples stay together, and here are the kind where they don't. And you have choice. You have a choice to change things.
And I think the major factor was the presence of contempt.
Right.
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 If one partner was demonstrating, you know, the rolling of the eyes or looking away or the dismissal of the other person's important communications, that was ridiculously predictive of the marriage breaking up.
Good memory.
Yeah. So when I try to help people to conduct more powerful surveys, one of the first things I do is I say, okay, you don't want to pre-code or force people into these categories. You
right.
want to post-code. You want to ask the type of open-ended questions that you might ask in a conversation and allow them to say whatever the heck they want to say. And then you want to create a coding scheme so that you can observe patterns in their coding.
The more specific you can get, like, for example, what brought you here today? You know, what brought you to the site? What were you looking for? Tell me more about that. The more specific you can get, the better you understand that prospect, and the more you're able to tell them the kinds of things they need to hear, if appropriate, to what you're selling.
Yep, absolutely. So most people, when they ask those open-ended questions, they don't postcode them.
Right.
When you do postcode them, you can not only get a sense of the relative frequency with which each concern or desire occurs, which really corresponds to the size of an opportunity or problem in the market, but you can also get a sense of, if you look at the relationship of that code to other variables in your survey, you can get a sense of whether a particular concern occurs more among men than women. Does it occur more among older people than younger people? Is there a particular concern that tends to be expressed with a longer answer than other concerns? Is there a concern that's associated with people being willing to leave their phone number or looking for more of a relationship? You get all this incredibly rich data that most people don't get. And so I'm very, very much in favor of postcoding. Thanks very much for your time and attention. If you'd like to find out more about the comprehensive marketing research system I've used to succeed in market after market, please visit howtodoubleyourbusiness.com. That's how to double your business.com.